have so much. I would like to comment. Hey, do you guys know about this tutor program thing?
No.
Yeah. This is what happens when they don't... I don't actually have access to, like, SIP and things like that, so I'm not sure what announcements you guys get. There is a... programs, maybe they're at work. There are 3Ls. I think they're all 3Ls. Maybe some are 2Ls who did well in all of their 1L classes that are available as tutors for all of your subject matter. Did you guys know that? Yeah. Yes and no?
Yes.
Maybe? Dean Saran, maybe? Yes. Dean Saran runs this program. And they are... she told me she also has tried very hard to get this word out, but does not feel like she's been successful at doing so by putting it on SIP and on Facebook pages and things like that. Kayla, do you have a question about it?
No, I signed up for one for a different class.
That's how it works. So you contact Dean Saran, you say, I want, you know, someone to help me with prim, and then they give you...
And who your professor is, so they try to match it with someone who wants...
Yeah. So, in some brilliant move, they did not hire anybody who's ever taken property from me. and I have no say in this process, so I was just given the names last week and realized that none of them had actually... They did well in their classes, but... did no one do well in my class? No, I had given them a list of names of people. I had actually tried to recruit some people to... But they changed this program. It was going to be a TA. I was going to have, somebody actually assigned to my class to kind of do, sample problems and stuff. And, the week before classes started, they changed this program to being, this kind of tutor program. And... So, and when they did so, my students decided weren't interested in doing that. There are people who did well in their property classes. They just weren't my property class, so they had a different book, unfortunately. But some things like adverse possession, rules of easements are very similar. They just might not have had the exact same cases and things that you guys have. So you can always go to Dean Saran and ask for a name and get matched up with somebody, but I'm going to try and track down one or two of the people to work with specifically and give them a bunch of sample problems they could go over with you, maybe then have them do mini review sessions on topics that I think everybody is struggling on. If any of you guys have thoughts of what you think would be, you'd actually find helpful and that you'd actually go to, let me know, because I want to try and make this something that is useful and helpful to you. And right now, I've been told that nobody has used it. There's only one person from property who's requested somebody. So
we have resources at our fingertips. Let us use them.
Yes.
Do you put any of your old exam problems are in the library at all, just for sample problems?
Well, that's a thing one can do?
Yeah.
Yeah. No?
Okay.
This is what... Yeah, I didn't know that was a thing you could do.
Oh, yeah, I just was wondering. And then, do you know if the Foreign AV Center has, property, the CDs at all of your classes?
Yes.
They do.
I don't even understand your question.
Yes.
The AV Center has something or other about property?
It's a property book,
An audio review book with distinguished professors from around wherever.
There you go.
There's two different brands. Yeah. There's Barbary and something.
Ooh, if it's Barbary, the woman, if it's still the woman who does Barbary for property, it's Paula Francie. She's awesome and she sings. I found her very entertaining when I did Barbary. I know that was 15 years ago, but I'm guessing it's still the same. Does not change as much as some of the other topics. And there's also a lot of treatises. I like manuals. I find that to be probably one of the better ones if you're sitting there. Not treatises, but what do you call those things? The study book guide things. There's some word for it. Horn book study guide thingers. Yeah, there's probably actually some phrase that I'm not remembering. Well, okay, you know, feel free to, you know, email me or pass me secretive notes where you don't, like, want to reveal your name, and I will try and figure out what would be kind of the topics that people are feeling the most confused about and the style that would be helpful. I could definitely give them old exams and have them do sample exams with you guys. I could give them lists of... like multiple choice questions that you could use as a little test for yourself to see whether or not you are understanding what's going on. Future interests, as I mentioned, will not be putting on the exam. So, and the other property professors cover a lot more of future interests than I do. So I'm not sure. I think if you start asking the tutors about future interests, you might get more confused. Yes, ma'am.
Besides future interests, will there be any, like the topics that we were tested on, will those not be?
So some of them, I will make your exam a limited world exam. I'm still trying to determine that based on how well people seem to understand things on the assignments. So basically, if I finish grading the assignments, I'm like, my gosh, everybody really understands GIFs. I know this is not what you want to hear. I will not test on that. We probably prefer I choose the things that everyone did well and understood. And probably next week I'll be able to put up a list of what will be on the exam and what won't be on the exam, so you can kind of start targeting your studying a little bit more. I'll just take a few things off. I'll probably will not test you on adverse possession directly, but it might come up in terms of prescriptive easements that we'll talk about today. Easements will definitely be on the exam. Covenants will definitely be on the exam. Takings will definitely be on the exam. Co-ownership. We've studied co-ownership, but we didn't have any assignment on that. That'll be fair game. But I'll do that next time, right? I'll sit down and be able to do that on Monday. Questions? Thoughts? Concerns? All right, so last time we started talking about easements. And we started talking about the different categories of easements, and we went over express easements. Most easements are express easements. Most easements are just kind of put in writing, and we're just going to look at the terms of that easement to try and figure out what they mean. And then the cases involving express easements are usually cases that are involving kind of just interpreting those words, right? Kind of some of the similar things maybe we saw when we were looking at wills or conveyances or other documents, right? We might just have a little bit of battle about when there's ambiguities. And when there's ambiguities, we try not to go outside of the four corners of the document. We try to look at the document itself to understand what's going on. But we've got, when that's not helpful, a couple different public policy strains going on behind the scenes that help us resolve kind of some of the issues that we might see in express easements. And the biggest one is probably a public policy that disfavors restraints on land. Public policy that wants lands to be kind of freely alienable, and the more kind of interests and layers we put on top of land, the more cumbersome it is. If you convey a piece of property that has a bunch of easements on it, there's a lot more kind of people involved, a lot more kind of restraints on the land, and we kind of tend to disfavor that. Putting that alongside, however, was something that sometimes comes at odds with that, is more and more jurisdictions are actually just trying to really embody the intent of the parties. So even if the four corners of that easement, express easement, are themselves very clear, trying to do as much as we can to figure out what do these people really mean to do, what was the intent in here, and how can we best embody that. So those are two kind of public policy reasons we see running behind a lot of our easement discussions, and sometimes they're going in the same direction and it's fine, and sometimes when they come into a conflict, it's hard to know which one the courts are going to find a stronger reasoning. And this just kind of differs by courts. The modern trend, though, more and more courts seem to be ending up on the favor of looking at the intent of the parties as being the most important aspect. All right, so that's express easements. So we started to investigate the world of implied easements. All right, so all of the rest of our easements that we're going to talk about are things that are not in writing. And so yet there's, for some reason, we think there's a good justification for recognizing these easements, even though the parties did not sit down and actually make an express agreement in writing. And it's a long list of categories that we might, of types of easements that we might find that are not in writing, but I don't want you to suggest that it's actually a large body of our easements, right? Most of our easements are expressed, but we're going to see there's quite a few categories of implied ones. The first implied one that we talked about was implied by prior use. And we did this right at the end of the class last time, and I know it went a little quickly, that's why I wanted to just take a moment. Right, so here we are in our kind of our list here. So implied, we think of two easements as being what we think of as implied easements. And we're going to, we did prior use last time, we'll do necessity this time before we continue on down the rest of that list. Prior use. And this is the general test for prior use. Well, necessity is up there, and we'll you know, table it for a moment. That first item on the list is the one that seems to catch people up the most. Severance of unity. What do we mean by severance of unity? What does that phrase mean?
Like you have separate parcels, but they were all one originally?
Yes. They have to have started as being owned by one person. So if you have two parcels and there's a sewer line running through them, you don't automatically have an implied easement by prior use. You really have to have a situation where those parcels were originally owned by one person. And you can might go back pretty far. You might kind of pull up the deeds and go back, you know, 100 years in the conveyances. But at some point, they have to have been owned by one person. And not only that, it had to be that when they were owned by that one person, when they were one big parcel, that's when the thing that looks like an easement had to go into place. So you had a big parcel of land and you made a driveway on it. It's not really an easement because it's just the driveway on your property. But if you sold off half of that land, that driveway going through it now looks like an easement to that second half. Right? So this is, so it has to be prior use. It has to be use that was in place at the time of severance. It has to be a reasonably necessary use. If you have this, if you have that piece of parcel and you have the driveway going through right here and you sever it, is that a reasonably necessary use? I mean, maybe. Depends on if they can get out the road right there. Depends on kind of if there's other reasonable access. We also see a lot of these priorities not really, not always being driveways, but perhaps being things like sewage lines, telephone lines, things that we think of as being reasonably necessary for a comfortable daily life. A parent. A parent was the one that was a little bit tricky in the case about the sewer line last time, right? Why was it apparent that there was a sewage line easement? It's underground, so that doesn't sound very apparent. Why did the court find that it was apparent? Well?
Because the owners could have investigated and seen the problem. They would have had.
Well, they could have investigated, but how would they even know to investigate? Like, if you move to a piece of property, do you, like, kind of dig under the ground to see what's there?
They had noticed because pipes were showing.
They had noticed because of what?
These pipes were showing.
There, there weren't actually pipes showing on the ground. You really, you could walk out, you had no idea there was pipes running under your feet. Right.
Under the appliance.
There was appliances. It's a sewage line, so the appliance is the toilets.
Yeah.
Right? The toilet is the thing. So the plumbing. They have kind of, the court says you have kind of modern-day plumbing. So you're under some kind of constructive notice that there's probably sewage pipelines. Now, that doesn't actually tell you that you also should be under notice that you have the pipelines coming from your neighbor's house. But the court kind of reads that into it. Kind of, we know that sewage pipelines are, like, all connected here. If you looked at the structure of the street and you understood where your pipeline came from, it was reasonable for you to maybe understand that there was one coming from your neighbor's land. I think that this case actually shows a very generous interpretation of apparent. And this is why I wrote known or discoverable. That it was kind of not too tricky to think that there might be sewage lines running under your property and the type of thing that you maybe could have discovered or should have investigated. I think it's far from obvious. Even if you have noticed that you had your own sewage line, you don't necessarily... I don't assume that my sewage line is also connecting my neighbor's sewage through my pipelines, right? I assume most of us have sewage lines that connect us to the street. That's the normal mode of things. And continuous. right? That it is something that was kind of an ongoing use, not just a once-in-a-while type use. For sewage lines, or utility lines, it's very easy to meet that. For other types of easements, like rights-of-way easements, it might be less obvious that there's a real easement there. Of course, if this was in writing, it would just be an express easement, and we wouldn't have to kind of go through this list to try and figure it out. All right, so that we'll see some of these elements change a little bit as we get to necessity, but we also see some things that are in common. Instead of going through this list, let's first go through. Let's just look at the case of Burge versus the state of Vermont. Mary, did I call on you last time? What? No, okay. I wrote down that I was going to, and then I didn't. Okay. All right. Can you help us out with this?
Sure. So, was conveyed a piece of land that was situated between a body of water and a land that was owned by the state. The state blocked the plaintiff's entrance to access, or to the road to access the land, so like the plaintiff couldn't get to his property by land. He could only get to it by water.
Right.
And so the state is saying like the fact that we can get to it by water is sufficient, and that like he didn't necessarily need to be able to get across it by land, the court said.
Okay. So to understand our elements of strict, our elements for implied easements by necessity, we have to kind of think of some of the same things we thought of with our previous implied easement. And the first thing we need to think about is land ownership. Who owned this land? Was it originally part of one piece of property or not? So we have to, Mary, take one step back and just think about the land ownership timeline here. So who originally owned this land?
Florence Davis and Oliver.
You're right. So Davis owned in 1959, and we don't have before that, but at least in 1959 we know that Davis owned all of this land, some 7,000 acres, over 7,000 acres. And what did she do with her land?
Divided it up.
Right, amongst whom?
To the state. I don't know, it was the state and like others as well.
It's the state and then herself.
Oh, okay.
So she has over 7,000 acres of land. Beautiful land. This is like a picture of it. There's a moose on it. This is a picture I can find of this property. All right. Here, she has this land, and she donates 7,001 acres to the state of Vermont. For what purpose, do we know?
This is like a wildlife.
To use as a wildlife preserve. It's supposed to have kind of this rural character to it. That might be helpful to us to know. But so she undeveloped land, totally undeveloped land to the state, with the idea that the state is going to kind of use this as this preserved land. She holds on to, she retains 38 acres of it. When she retains it, she could have done an express easement by, which would it be, grant or reservation?
Reservation,
right? That's exactly what a very common thing would be, like, I'm conveying to you a bunch of my land, I'm going to hold on to it, to a little chunk of it, and I'm reserving an easement so I can get in and off of my little 38-acre chunk. She does not do so, however. She does not write that into the conveyance. Over time, and when she does that, when she makes this conveyance, that 38-acre parcel becomes landlocked, officially on the maps. Unofficially, there's a driveway. I think I have a picture of it. Here's a road. Unofficially, there's this road that actually can be used to reach that 38 acres. It goes through the state's property without an express easement, though. All right. There's some conveyances of the land that I'm not even sure who gets what, but some of the 38 acres is divided up into 18 different lots, and then one of these lots ends up with Burge, or two of these lots. Burge gets these two lots in 1997. How does Burge get to his property?
Does he just use the road?
He just uses this road. He uses this, it's a gravel road that then leads to State Road 114. It goes through the wildlife preserve. He uses this road for quite a while. Why is he the plaintiff here? Why is he the one suing and not the state of Vermont suing him for trespassing?
Doesn't he want to quiet title the rights to use that easement?
Yeah, but what suddenly happened? What suddenly happened that changed his mind? Like, he's been kind of traveling along this road for years, and suddenly he feels the need to bring a suit to quiet title. Charlotte, you see it? Yeah, they put up a fence across this road one day. So one day he's trying to come home, and all of a sudden there's a gate, a locked gate there. So the question is, so this is why he brings the action. So it's not actually that the state is suing him for trespassing. He's trying to kind of get his rights in this easement recognized. So this is why he needs to argue that he has an implied easement by necessity. All right, so much like our implied easement by prior use, our implied easement by necessity has to start out with this severance of unity. Is that met here, Mary?
Yes,
exactly, right? It had all been owned by Davis at one point, and then it was split up. The other thing we have to try and figure out, though, is whether or not we think this that severance led to... Let me see if I have the list here. Oh, I don't have the list. Okay. All right. The what else do we need to show for easement by necessity, other than severance of unity?
That also the prior use.
All right. So if we were going to argue that this is an easement by prior use, right? So that would be we could try and argue this as an implied easement by prior use, right? Then we'd have to be going back to this test. We'd have to ask, was the use in place before the severance of title? Is it reasonably necessary? Is it apparent? Is it continuous? Do you think we can meet that test? What do you guys think? Do you think we could have met this test, our prior use test? They're not arguing prior use here. Maybe it was argued in the alternative and it was shut down earlier, but Amanda, you have thoughts on this?
I think you could argue it because, I mean, maybe with the roads there, maybe that in order to get to the land, you probably used it, and that he's been using it for years, so it was apparent and reasonably necessary.
Yeah. I think a lot of these we would do fine on. I think the lack of prior use might have been just a lack of information, perhaps, preventing it. Ben, you have thoughts here?
Yeah, we bought it in 97, and this is 06, so that's 2 years for 10 years.
Well, it's not prescription, right? So there isn't actually like a rule that has to kind of be in continuous use in the same way we think of it in the adverse possession context. We just kind of think of it as being kind of, you know, relatively continuous use. We don't have a statute of limitations, though, in the same way, of a certain number of years. Kayla?
I was kind of perhaps questioning the apparent, if there's no one's double use of it, because there's not like a sign saying this is allocated there. Or, I mean, 30 acres is a lot of land, 7,000 acres is a lot of land. I don't even know. And we've got to discover the building using this road and using your purpose. That would be the only one I think
they... Yeah, I mean, I see your argument, but at the same time, if we're going to find, like, somebody's sewage line underneath their property is discoverable, I think a road leading to somebody's house is relatively apparent and discoverable. It's true, like, if, you know, especially a state agency as opposed to kind of a normal residential neighbor might not see them that often because they tend to not be as diligent landowners. They're not present on the land the same way your next door neighbor is present on the land. But I think that is probably relatively easy to meet the apparent discoverable one. Ben?
So with government entity or government property can adversely possess it, is there somewhere...
He can't argue. We'll get to prescriptive easements in a minute, but there's a reason why he can't argue prescriptive easement, and it's because it's state-owned property. Quite often, when people are arguing that they have an easement, they are arguing multiple theories in parallel.
So they will put on the, you know, in their complaint or in their answer in their list of defenses, they'll be like, I've gotten implied by prior use, I've gotten implied by necessity, I've got one by estoppel, I've got one by prescriptive use, and they kind of try all of them. And sometimes you have ones that actually fit multiple categories. You might have one that looks actually quite similar to both prior use and necessity. We don't have a lot of the background information here that we might want. I think that the prior use might have been tricky. I'm not exactly sure when that road went in and how often it was used and when it was used. So the prior use means that it had to have been in use before that 38 acres was broke off of the 7,000. And I, just because of the timeline here and the difference in dates, I'm not sure that it was really in use at that time. But it, we don't even have evidence that Davis really... We have evidence she retained that parcel, but not really that she actively used that parcel. So I think that might bring us our... I think prior use might be our hard part. Okay, but so if we're looking at necessity then, we talk about severance of unity. What about loss of access? Can we meet the loss of access prong here?
Yeah, because... They put up the
gate,
locked it out. So
right, okay, so that's not exactly what we mean by loss of access for establishing...
Oh, loss of access to, the road. Well, yeah, mm-hmm. Because it was landlocked other than that.
It's like loss of access to your property. It's basically, it's just a way of saying, is your property landlocked? Is there any way that you can access your property? That's tricky here in some ways because it is made landlocked. And he lost access, he does not have access, Davis lost access, sure, 38 acres, Burge has inherited this loss of access. They don't have access to public street, but we'll see once we get the necessity prong, there's a question about whether we really lose access if there's alternative ways to access your property. All right, necessity. How do we determine whether or not there's necessity?
Well, the court draws a distinction between, a mere inconvenience and actual necessity. So, necessity only exists when there's a lack of, reasonably practical access to the property.
Exactly. That's the test we get from Vermont. That's the phrase they like, reasonably practical access. So, well, for a couple things I want to point out. When we think about necessity, we don't actually think about Burge's necessity today, although it sounds like that's what we're talking about. Usually I'll ask the question about necessity, we're going to go back to that time of severance. Was access lost at that time, and is there a necessity for them to access it? They put it in today's terms, but we can be very tempted to look at a landlocked parcel today and say that person has a necessity to reach the road. But we need to actually go back to at the point in time when the severance happened and answer the question at that point. Especially because there might have been a lot of changes in roads and things like that. All right. So at the time the property was severed, the claimant's land did not border a public street or have any other existing easement over private land to get to a public street. That is what is meant by necessity. This court gives us a slightly different test than what the majority rule is. The majority rule, which the court discusses but rejects, is a strict necessity rule. Under the strict necessity rule, arguably, there is no necessity here. Because how can he access his property?
By water,
by boat, or maybe he could swim. All right, he could take a boat to his property. There is a legal way that he can access his property. This court says boat access, however, is not enough. It cites a restatement, actually, for the proposition that water access is generally not sufficient to make reasonably effective use of property today. The minority rule is often called reasonable necessity or sometimes described as being a feasible, effective access. Vermont's rule is very similar, but they adopt their own phrase, which is this reasonably practical access. The court says there's a lack of reasonably practical access is the problem here. In describing this reasonable practical access, where we still have a hard time really determining when that's met.
So the court gives us three things to consider in trying to assess reasonably practical access. And I think that these three elements are actually also good for the minority rule of thinking about just the feasible effective. It's hard to figure out exactly the right difference between the minority and Vermont rules. These are very similar phrases. You just have to kind of look at how the cases describe it. They talk about ease. In fact, they talk about ease, frequency, and scope, or ease, dimension, and scope. Ease. First, the court points out that water access is insufficient because it's just not that easy. Right? Sometimes there's really bad weather. Sometimes there's really high tides. Sometimes it's the constant vicissitudes of motorboats, weather, and weather conditions. Right? That this is not an easy way. Stormy weather and high waves might make water access difficult. It could be unpleasant if you were sick or infirm or old or really young. Dimension or frequency. And the second theme that the court harps on is this idea of constant access. Right? One of the problems with the access by water is that it actually isn't available all year round. That there are times when this water is frozen. That there are times, perhaps, when the water levels are so low you couldn't bring too many boats through. That there, and it's, remember this, it's something in there, the certain months of the year or something like that, that they can't access it?
Yeah, they said like there are certain months during the year where the water would be completely frozen, they wouldn't be able to use it at all.
Alright, so the court seems to say that this is something we should think about. This, like, this frequency, the fact that you would be limited in your access to the property is something we should consider in trying to assess reasonably practical access. And scope. Finally, the court implies that the scope of it, what types of things you can transport, should matter. And in particular, like, the idea that just being able to hike into your property is not really the same as being able to bring an automobile. And the court says specifically, we depend on roads and automobiles for transporting not only our family and friends, but all our basic necessities to and from our homes. Suggesting that in Vermont, access has to be sufficient to allow automobile access. Ian.
So you said, probably under the majority rule, that water access would have been fine, which seemed weird to me because that, like, you could say, like, oh, you can use a helicopter to get to your land, so there would never be a time that you would win under this argument, right?
Yeah, okay, so that's a very good point. So there is now a thought that now that we have an ability to access all property by air, for the most part, maybe we could find some circumstances with this piece of property that there was, I don't know, the topography or something was such that you couldn't actually, like, land a helicopter there or something. But it does seem to suggest that maybe any place you could land a helicopter would not meet the majority strict necessity rules. Courts have actually kind of not gone that far. But they have said if you can hike into it, if you can get there by boat, it doesn't meet the strict necessity. They have not made the kind of taken the Vermont approach that we're really talking about, like automobile access. But necessity easements only last as long as the necessity is there. So arguably, if we get better about air travel, like, improves and it's actually quite easy to go from place to place by helicopter or, I don't know, teleportation, then your easement by necessity would disappear. It's only lasts as long as the necessity lasts. So if you have actually other methods of access that develop with technological changes, then there's an argument for getting rid of easement by necessity.
Jane? Strict necessity as the majority rule was only at the time of this case, right? Like, now it's the minority rule.
Is it the minority rule now?
Yes.
I have to look at the changes then.
I just want to make sure that I'm not confused, because it says, under the traditional approach, male minority view, strict is required.
Well, then it's probably now the minority rule. I always thought of it as the majority rule, but I'm not very good at keeping track of how many states are changing their approach.
I just want to make sure that on, like, the test or whatever we would go with.
No, I'll double check that. I actually thought it still was the majority. It was the majority at the time of this case, and I did not realize that more states have now gone towards the reasonable access. This is just kind of
of those things that's kind of fluctuating as courts kind of adopt go with the modern. The modern trend, so that like I thought it was still majority rule, but the modern trend is towards a more reasonable approach, because this idea that hiking in or boating in kind of seems ridiculous, as you guys seem to kind of naturally feel that could not have been what was intended. Ben.
The lower court kind of misinterpreted strict necessity. Is that what I'm reading? Because they're saying that it wasn't to interpret it as sort of an adjective for necessity, but that only had to do with necessity. So that's a little confusing to me, but it kind of seems like they're saying the lower court interpreted the word wrong and they're using it correctly.
Yeah, so there's some discussion there about is strict necessity really describing a type of necessity, or are we saying that is the only reason possible is necessity? So I think you're right. There is this conversation about have they interpreted it correctly, but I think that in most jurisdictions, strict necessity is taken to actually modify necessity and describe a type of necessity. The other thing that the court kind of emphasizes is that necessity is not the same thing as inconvenience. Not even extreme inconvenience. And there's often cases about people whose their alternative access is to build a road that goes up over some mountains, or they have to blast through some rocks or something that would be quite expensive. And none of that they draw this difference that I think can be hard to draw sometimes between what's inconvenient and what's impracticable. So the court's standard is a practicability standard, not a convenience standard. I actually agree with the casebook authors who suggest that this is not a very clear test. It requires us to kind of do this case-by-case analysis into what we really think of as practicable, and that is not always easy to determine. It makes it perhaps fulfill some of our other public policy goals of making a better use of land, of actually getting at the intent of the parties. But the results from this test are not very predictable. All right, why should we recognize easements by necessity at all? Right? Why not require people to get express easements? Like, this woman was conveying this land. She held on to 38 acres. Doesn't it seem possible or realistic to say if she wanted to reserve an easement, she should have reserved an easement? Why not require that? What are our public policy reasons we might have for adopting easements by necessity? Sam?
Labor of the land policy, where you want the land to be put to its best use, if someone can't access their land, then therefore they wouldn't be able to put that land to use.
Yeah. So I think that's true. I think we have kind of this idea that we want land to be put to their kind of highest and best use, and that's got to include at least being able to access the land. You could definitely see, though, that it wouldn't have been ridiculous for courts to adopt a different approach that just say, you want that? Bargain for it. Buy it. Right? Even if you bought a landlocked parcel today, you can do that. You don't automatically get an easement by necessity. And you probably got that land pretty cheap because it was landlocked. And so now it's on you to try and negotiate something with your neighbors to buy an easement from some of them. Maybe that should have been required. Any other kind of public policy reason you can think of for recognizing an easement by necessity? Tim?
If you had land that you couldn't get, whoever your neighbors were, could just take it by adverse possession.
Oh, that's an interesting one. Yeah, so maybe you're putting even a diligent landowner might be more at risk of losing their land if they don't have the ability to actually access and monitor it. I hadn't thought of that one, yeah. Another really common one that's given is the presumed intent of the parties. And particularly here where this woman was actually donating like 7,000 acres to the state, it somehow maybe feels like wrong that we didn't let her access that small little parcel that she held on to. I mean, 38 acres is big, but in comparison to what she donated. But what about presumed intent of the parties here? What do you think, Mary? What do you think Ms. Flora Davis and the state of Vermont, do you think they originally intended for her to...
Yeah, they did. I mean, when there's a road that connects her property to the main road, like, it just kind of seems like it would almost have to go unspoken. Like, yeah, you can use the road to get off and on to your property.
I mean, maybe the state of Vermont's going to say, no, no, that's just the road that we use to kind of, for upkeep of our wildlife preserve. Anyone think maybe their intent was not to have a road, not to have road access? No, everybody's like, man, if you got 38 acres, you must have a road.
Intent to the two parties.
I mean, we don't have a good idea of what the intent of the parties was. We don't have good records of that going back. She's not still around for us to go ask. Arguably, this kind of rural, undeveloped land that's going to be a wildlife refuge, maybe she didn't really intend for it to be a road there. Maybe she wanted this to be kind of a place that was that she only accessed by boat and that had retained a rural character. And it was just her own little camping place and amongst it. The argument against that is that she quickly subdivides it into 18 lots. It does appear that instead she actually holds onto this to make some money off the land, like that she's going to sell this off. And they'll be really valuable kind of vacation home spots because they'll be kind of in the midst of this wildlife reserve. But you could see how getting at the intent of the parties can be tricky. And particularly when many of these are going back like 100 years to look at the deeds. So we're just kind of presuming the intent. Most people presume you wanted access. Presume that you didn't mean to cut your access off. And as you guys said already, policy favoring productive use of land. Those are the two reasons, those are the two justifications given for recognizing an easement by necessity. You can kind of explicitly say that you don't want access. So we think of express easements as giving you kind of rights to access. You might in the deed kind of explicitly note that you do not mean for there to be an easement across the land. You mean for this to be rural land and retain that character. Or you only mean for the access, you want to only access the road by bicycle. We do allow people, although we have public policy reasons, including pretty strong ones, for recognizing easements by necessity. We allow parties to kind of negotiate within their conveyances to say, we don't mean to retain an easement here. In case somebody, you know, 20 years from now is going to try and suggest there was an easement by necessity here, we're going to kind of tell you right now that that is not what we're intending to create. So it's kind of like an express non-creation of an easement.
Yeah. So if you buy a piece of landlocked land, like you said, it'd probably be pretty cheap because you can't get on and off of it. You wouldn't get a easement by necessity because there was no unity of severance. So
it's uncertain, right? You can't just look at a piece of property and say this is landlocked and therefore there's probably an easement by necessity. You'd have to go back in title and say how much of this was there ever unity of title here? And was this parcel severed from a unity of title? Right? So it doesn't necessarily mean your purchase today. And here, in this case, it wasn't Burge's purchase that severed the unity. It was Davis's donation and retention of 38% severed the unity. So it's my point is just that we can't necessarily look at a parcel today and determine whether or not an easement by prior use or an easement by necessity is present without pulling up land records and asking these questions. And the severance of unity question is the one that most people overlook because they just say, oh, landlocked must be necessity, but there's you got to have severed unity.
Why doesn't Davis's 18 lot giving service of 17 units. I mean, that was a big single parcel, and then that was for everybody.
Sure, so that 18, but all that's going to give you is access to the other 38 acres. But you want to get off the 38 acres. Does that make sense? So absolutely, if we could then look at the larger parcel that's like 7,039 acres, and there's one severance right there, the 7,001 from the 38. We want to get off of that 38 acres, and it requires us to go through part of that 7,000. She then subdivides that 38 acres into 18 lots. Absolutely, there might be an argument that there's a reason why you need to cross part of the other 38 acres, but it doesn't help you if you're still trapped within the 7,000, right? You still need a road out. Tim?
Is everything west of the Mississippi, does that all have severance of unity? The entire thing.
No, it goes back to, so we don't, we have to go back to where you find the first deed. Okay. The first patent. And so sometimes we do have cases where you go back to the original patent that you got from the U.S. that somebody got from the U.S. government.
So, okay.
But we don't count the Louisiana Purchase as being all part of one piece of property that then got sent up. We have to look for wherever you saw the first recorded deed or patent. Yeah? I like the argument. It'd be a large parcel. Okay. So let's see. Let's move on to prescription because it's relatively close. All of these things are kind of actually closely related in concept. And you can see how very similar circumstances might lead to any of them, right? We could see how, I think it was Ben that pointed out, we might have had some option for arguing prescription here if there weren't a prohibition against adverse possession of prescription against government entities, right? It was not available in that case. Otherwise, we could have looked up kind of the statute of limitations and things like that and try to figure out whether it fit. All right. So acquiring easements by prescription is very similar to acquiring title to property by adverse possession. The only difference is here is that you're not getting the entire title to the property. You're just getting a right to use part of the property. You're getting an easement in the property. So let's look at the Odell case. Nobody's here today. Jordan, can you help us with this one?
Sure. Odell bought this land in a home that used to be a church. And he has a driveway that connects to a main road from, I think, I don't know, either the south or the north side. And there's a property behind him that acts as the road through this gravel path.
Let me give you a helpful picture. Hopefully, a helpful picture.
Right, and pretty much he wants an easement. Even though he has access to the road, to his property from the road through a driveway, he wants to, access his property from the other side and use, this other path.
Right, okay, so now we see very clearly from this picture why necessity isn't going to be available to him, right? Here's his house, and he has access out to, whatever this is, Route 15, from this other driveway and parking area. But what he really wants is to use this horseshoe-shaped one, right? You can picture this. My mouse is a little weird. He drives in, parks here. He wants to use this. But this gravel pathway is the questionable thing. Who owns this property where the gravel pathway is? Is that actually on Odell's land or not?
He wasn't sure who actually owned it.
All right, yeah, so we don't have anything explaining to us who owns the property underlying the gravel lane, right? So Odell's property, we're going to say, goes up to that gravel lane. Stegall's also goes up to the gravel lane. So neither Stegall nor Odell, we have no idea who owns that property underneath that gravel lane. All right, so that person isn't involved in the case. Instead of these two neighbors, why are they fighting here? Why is Stegall upset with Odell? They just don't like each other. There's definitely some conflict with neighbors here. What is the legal argument? What is the legal argument that Stegall is making? Challenging Odell. How are these two people the parties to the case? Right? Why wouldn't this just be owner of the gravel lane bringing a trespass action against Odell? What's the dispute here?
Well, I mean, I feel like if Odell doesn't need to use it, why should he be cutting across Stegall's land? He already attaches to the road.
But why does Stegall care? Because it's not Stegall's land, though. What does Stegall have? What's Stegall's right? How would we describe his property right here?
Well, he's an easement because he's landlocked.
He has an easement. We actually don't know the basis for the creation of his easement. It's just not given here. We don't know if he got it because it was an easement by necessity, or if he got it because of prior use. Maybe he got it because it was actually an express easement somewhere on his deed. We don't know. But we do know that the courts are recognizing that he had, there's not a dispute over his easement in that gravel.
They're bringing a trespass charge?
Who is?
I thought, is that what you said? The steeple to against him?
No, I'm saying, why isn't that what it is, right? Normally, if we look at a case like this, it's not, we would usually, if we look at somebody who's arguing, hey, you don't have an easement there, it's usually the underlying landowner suggesting the person is trespassing. But that is not exactly what's happening here. It's a kind of a form of a trespass. But what it is it's the easement holder arguing that they don't want the neighbor to add to their easement, an additional burden on the easement. Yeah.
Stiegel has to pay for wear and tear.
That's Stiegel's argument. Right? He's like, look, I have this easement that I've gotten long ago, and I maintain this road because of that easement. I'm the one who pays for the gravel, I'm the one who pays for plowing, or whatever it is. Right? You are not, you don't have an easement. So you can't just come on and start using this easement. You have no rights to this easement. It's my easement. And so you're interfering kind of with my use of the easement. So this is why the neighbors are bringing this case against each other. As you guys already noted, it's actually probably because they hate each other for other reasons, because Hugo would really care too much about him driving it, right? Or he's not even asking, he's not bringing a case asking him for help him pay for the driveway. He's like, I want you off. I don't want you to use that driveway. All right, so Odell argues, well, hey, I have an easement in that gravel driveway too. Now, what is his argument, Jordan, for his basis for it? Okay. All right, so what is the test? What are the standard elements, then, for prescriptive easement? How are we going to go through and figure out whether or not there's a prescriptive easement here?
It was to add a person claiming an easement has to have adverse use of another's land, that the adverse use was continuous and interrupted.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually known to the owner of the land, so open and notorious. And it was reasonably identified starting point, ending point, line, and width of the land was adversely used. So I guess you identified exactly what you're trying to adversely claim.
Yeah, so this is, I just point out that this, their description here of their test is a little bit different kind of than the standards description we see. This would be kind of the standard list. Open and notorious use, right? That's something we've seen before. Adverse use of the land. Continuous and uninterrupted use. Exclusive use for the statutory limitations period. That is a kind of our standard test for a prescriptive easement, and we'll go through those elements in a minute. In this case, in West Virginia, they changed the wording of their test a little bit. It's a slightly different approach, but we see similarities, right? Adverse use of another's land, continuous and uninterrupted for at least 10 years, so that's the statute of limitations there. Open and notorious. And then this is this twist we see in West Virginia. Reasonably identifiable starting point, ending point, line, and width of land that was adversely used in the manner or purpose for which it was used. So here in West Virginia, when we're looking at easements, prescriptive easements, we want to actually be able to kind of specifically identify how big and how long the access way is or the road or something like that. They write the actual kind of starting point, ending point, and width of it. They want kind of real dimensions, not just kind of like I periodically drive through this parking lot or I kind of meander through the woods. Like there has to be a real kind of defined path in West Virginia. So you can see that we might have some states that kind of change the test a little bit, but the general test still is following the same ideas that we learned in our other adverse possession discussion. All right. So Jordan, let's think about these elements. Is there open and notorious use of the land in this case?
It seems so, yes.
Yeah, I think so, right? And when the way that we describe open and notorious use of the land, remember when we talked about it in the context of land ownership, we said you had to kind of use the land in a way that people would kind of see that you were using it like a landowner would, and kind of open. Here you say the claimant must have used the land as if he had an easement. They had to use the land as though somebody who had an easement would use it, which doesn't mean kind of
you're occupying it every moment of the day, right? You're using it kind of as if it's a driveway easement, you're kind of using it frequently enough as a driveway that it's open and people can see you. Yeah.
I have a question. I thought this was kind of funny because I don't know if anyone watches Bob's Burgers, but it kind of reminded me of Harold and Edith, like from the very grumpy old couple, pretty much. What they did was they took seven photographs of Lincoln driving on the lane, and does that kind of like work against them, like the ultimate and notorious use?
Yeah, I mean, if they wanted to argue that there wasn't open and notorious use, it would work against them if they're taking pictures of them actually using it. But you can see how the evidence here can be kind of tricky, because at one point they need to argue that the people are using it if they're going to try and suggest that it's a trespass and that it's interfering with their use of the easement. But on the other hand, they're conceding open and notorious here. They are not actually arguing that it's not open and notorious. They're conceding that, so it doesn't hurt them to go and show these pictures. In fact, usually we see courts saying if the owner of the servient land actually knew about the use, then we think of that as being open and notorious. The owner of the servient land here doesn't know about the use because we have no idea who that person is, actually. So we have a slightly different kind of test because it's not about what the landowners. Notice open and notorious and kind of just generally ideas about prescriptive easements means you can never get a negative prescriptive easement. You guys remember negative easements? What would be an example of a negative easement?
I think it's you're stopping the servient landowner from doing something on their own property.
Exactly. Right? And what's an example of one? But right. So do you see how that is something you can't get by prescription? It's really just kind of hard to demonstrate that it would be open and notorious. No court has ever recognized negative easements by prescription. All right. So open and notorious. We're not too. That doesn't seem too hard to figure out here. What about the adverse use, Jordan?
No, that seems to be the one the court's looking at closely.
Yeah, and why?
One reason was because they couldn't show that Stegall actually owned that property, so they're not adverse using it against them.
Yeah.
The owner.
Right, so it's got to be adverse use against this unknown landowner. So how should we examine that question of whether or not it's adverse?
I guess if it's their easement, then they're kind of like the owner, but there's no way of knowing.
This is really tricky, and we have to end up kind of adopting, kind of looking to what this jurisdiction's background presumptions are. Right? So, generally we think of it, describing adverse use as the claimant saying he had to act as though he had the right to use the servient land. He had to act as though he had an easement, suggesting that he had full rights to use the easement. If the claimant uses the land with permission, remember that's not adverse use. So the question is whether or not we assume that they had permission. And we've seen cases in our adverse possession discussion that kind of had presumptions going both ways. In some jurisdictions, they're just going to kind of assume that the use is adverse if there's nobody who's explicitly come forward and given you permission. But perhaps you remember another case actually about churches and church parking lots had the presumption go the other way and said, no, we're going to presume that you had permission. We're just going to presume that all landowners are nice and they're giving you a license or access across the land. And therefore, it's not adverse use. The hard part here, the really annoying part for Liddell, is that the court actually changed its position on what it thought the default presumption should be in this case. So when the trial court was looking at this case, the presumption was that use was hostile, that it was adverse. The presumption was that the landowner was not giving you permission. Here, this is West Virginia's highest court, the Supreme Court of Appeals, they call it, reverses that presumption. Which is very tricky, perhaps, particularly for Odell, not just because he didn't have warning, but he might have argued his case differently. He might have taken steps differently to try and overcome that presumption, but he thought the presumption went the other direction. So, in general, open and continuous use of another property is presumed to be adverse. However, in this jurisdiction and in a few others, they are presuming that the opposite. They're presuming that you have permission unless you can show specifically that the landowner hasn't given you permission. Notice that that is going to be impossible in cases where you don't know who the landowner is. If you can't figure out who the underlying landowner is, as often happens with adverse possession issues, right? That's the whole point, is that they're like a landowner that's absent. You can't figure out who they are. You're never going to be able to show adversity. Some courts say that unfenced, undeveloped land is presumed to be by permission of the owner. Why might we adopt such a rule? Unfenced, undeveloped land. Should we say presumed adverse or not? Francis?
A lot of times, if it's a large parcel that someone's not at all the time, or you can't come to regularly, you can't expect them to be as diligent on the margin. It's probably like a ranch or something of that nature. You wouldn't be able to see everything at all times.
Absolutely. Maybe we look at it and we say these are really large undeveloped parcels. It's just harder for somebody to be a diligent landowner. Let's be a little bit nicer to them. A lot of courts seem to just feel like, let's just assume that person's being neighborly. They didn't put up a fence. They're kind of suggesting that it's okay for you to go through their land. When I was a kid, our fences fell apart because we were lazy people. Right, so the fences, so I lived in the middle of the block, and the fences just kind of deteriorated, and they just fell over one day. And that was a signal somehow to everyone on the street that that would be the best place to, of course, cut through the block so you didn't have to walk all the way down. So our yard, for a couple of years until we got around to putting another fence up, became just a neighborhood pathway. Because of it was unfenced. So if a presumption here is that an unfenced yard is suggesting to your neighbors, please, please, I'm giving you access. This is a license. I'm allowing all of you, because I'm such a nice person, to use this pathway. So that's what courts say. But undeveloped, unfenced land is a suggestion to people that it's a license. And now it's not kind of necessarily, it's not kind of giving... So it gives you no ability. So my neighbors then would have no ability to get actually adverse possession or even a prescriptive easement for walking through my yard, because it's a presumption that by taking down my fence, I was giving them permission to use it. Okay. The biggest thing that we can tell here, much like we saw in our last discussions of adverse possession, is we really want to just look for evidence that the person hasn't been given a license, hasn't been given some type of permission to use that land. And here, in this court, they're going to presume it. All right, continuous and uninterrupted. What do you think?
Yes.
Yes, and I think particularly because, you notice, they're invoking the idea of tacking. Here, right? He's talking not just about his use, but he mentions the use by the church, right? That the church used this. He's adding on his use of it to the church's use to show that there's attacking and adding to meet the statute of limitations. Also, exclusive. Now, notice exclusive is not on the West Virginia list, but it is often mentioned in other courts. Do you think this looks like, how do we do exclusive use for an easement? Is it exclusive?
Doesn't seem like it.
Doesn't seem like it, right? Because the other people are using it. So how should we... So does an easement fail for... Do we fail for a prescriptive easement just if some, more than one person uses that driveway? I think exclusive use is tricky. Sometimes courts say the use must be exclusive. But the easement holder doesn't actually have the ability to exclude other people from the land, right? They just have the ability to use the easement themselves, right? They can't exclude the landowner, for example, from using. So exclusive, I think, is a very tricky element. Some courts still seem to include it on their list because they seem to just be reciting the same list that they use for other adverse possession. But when it comes down to applying it, they usually don't... interpret it in the same way. They tend to say something similar to things like, they kind of more equate it with continuous. It's got to be kind of a continual use of the land, which doesn't doesn't make sense to call it exclusive, but I feel like they just want to adopt the same list that they have for adverse possession generally and can't quite figure out how to apply it when it comes to the world of easements. Sam?
It also would fit if it was exclusive use as an easement, because it makes sense to allow multiple people to use the easement, but then let's say the property owner was using whatever you were using as the easement, then you can't take it away from them.
Man, I got lost in the middle there. This landowner was actually present, and that gravel driveway, maybe they used it as a driveway, maybe they used it for other things, I don't know what you would do else with the gravel. Maybe they have parties, they've had keggers out there like once a week or something, right? So all of those things would be permissible uses that would not necessarily disrupt your use of it as an easement. Right, there might be things they could do with it that would still allow you. The only thing we really get from exclusive, the only clear test that comes from courts, is that if all members of the public use it, if it is like a public driveway, a public boat launch or something like that, then we say that's not exclusive enough. But having it just be two property owners like that, I don't think should disrupt the exclusivity. And I haven't ever seen an opinion that suggests that just because the neighbor also uses the driveway, the other person can't get an easement. And then the statutory period, right? Statute of limitations is usually the same as it is for fee simple ownership of property. We saw shorter statute of limitations for personal property, like for the paintings and the watches and stuff like that. But the one for land is usually the same exact thing for easements as it is for getting full ownership of land. All right, let me see. Our justification for prescriptive easements is the same as our justification for adverse possession in general, and the same things that you guys saw before. No longer do we have intent of the parties, right, because that's not embodied in a prescriptive adverse possession type idea, but it is about kind of full use of the land, clearing up titles that might have been messy. You guys are like falling asleep, so let's take a break. I was going to try and get through a stopple, but let's take 10 minutes, stretch, jump up and down. Run up and down the stairs a few times. See what you can do. Estoppel. All right, let's finish up our easements. Okay. Where am I? All right, easements by estoppel. Let's look at Kinsel v. Meyer? All right. Let's jump over to the other Jordan. Hey, Jordan, what are you running for?
SBA director.
What does that mean?
It's like a representative for the class, so I help like vote on, make decisions like budgets and go to moot court competitions. Or I'm planning as a co-chair for the student of color dinner, so I'm also doing that.
But you can get us all money for things.
I can try.
Nice. All right, good person to know. All right, help us out with Kinsel versus Myers.
Public sewage line in, and so these neighbors had to join the public line, and it was going to be super inconvenient for one of them. They'd have to like dig up their driveway, so they were friends, so the other neighbor was like, well, you can just jump onto my line, and it was in her property. But then years later they decided they kind of wanted to take back that arrangement, and so that's what happened.
Yeah. Alright, so this is just kind of, that's just a generic sewage line, in case people, I know most of you are not homeowners, but just something people don't usually realize is that there's usually a main sewage line up the street, and it is the responsibility of the individual property owners to hook up from their house out to the main sewage line. The alternative to doing this is your own kind of septic system in your backyard, and in most urban areas, those are not allowed, right? So this is what you have to do. So we have a point in time, let's see, in 1981 is when in this neighborhood, they were building the main sewage line up by the road, and the homeowners were told, you guys now need to hook up to the main sewage line. They had to build their own kind of private sewer line out to the main one. And as Jordan tells us, these women were friends. Right? So here's a kind of a diagram of what this area looked like. These women were friends, and you see how, right, so here is the river road down here at the bottom is where the main sewage line is that they have to get to. And so you can see how on the Van Dyne, I don't know, we'll make up that pronunciation, Van Dyne land, you can see how it's not that hard for them to put their sewage line from their house out to the main road. But because of this creek bed, it is a little bit harder for the Bauer land to kind of draw, to build a direct sewage line. So these two women are buddies, and they agree that the Bauer people can take theirs over the Van Dyne land and connect up with that sewage line going through. Did they do this in writing, Jordan?
They don't.
God damn it, why not? What is wrong with people? Put this in writing. Put this in writing when they do. They did not put it in writing. Otherwise, that would be really, it would have been very easy. It would have been express easement. We could have just looked at that that way. Instead, this is just an oral agreement. Sometimes you see people referring to things as gentlemen's agreements, right? That they just kind of make this friendly agreement that they're going to do this sewage line. All right. How long was it used before the Van Dyne land people started objecting to its use?
I think it was a long time, like 25 years.
Yeah. So what happens is that there we have a couple people change. We have the properties changing hands over time, right? So it's no longer these two women who were friends who entered into this agreement, right? Otherwise, we might have had a different result. They would have still probably been friendly. The Bauer land gets sold to the Myers, and the Van Dyne land ends up in the hands of the Kienzels, which is actually a relative of Van Dyne's. This is like, I don't know, the daughter in the trust or something. It's 2003. So over 20 years later, that the Kienzel writes a letter and says, we don't want you using that sewage line anymore.
Okay. Which of our previous easements might we have tried to argue this would be? Could we have argued that this was an implied by prior use easement? What would be our problem with arguing that? What are we lacking? What's the first thing on our list for an easement implied by prior use? Amanda. Severance of unity, right? We would have had to have the Bauer Van Dyne land owned by the same people to even start the inquiry into the rest of those elements. Easement by necessity? Same thing. We don't have severance of unity. I don't know, we probably don't have necessity either, but we never even have to get to that discussion because we're never owned by the same people to start. Alright, but what about prescription? What about prescriptive use? Do we have prescriptive use here? Does this look like adverse possession, Jordan? What element of adverse possession runs us into trouble? Dom, you have an idea?
It was allowed.
It was explicit permission. Right? This was like, yes, please come use my property. That is not adverse and hostile under any element, any view of these texts, right? So we can't have prescriptive use. So this is why we get these easements by estoppel. Easements by estoppel are quite often things that look like prescriptive use, but started with permission. And this is why, actually, in many jurisdictions, they are called irrevocable licenses. Right? Remember we talked about licenses. We all give licenses to people every day. That's allowing them to enter our property, allowing them to use it, and welcoming our friends into our home. And licenses are always revocable. You can always, you know, kick your friend out or, you know, whatever, and things like that. But there's a point, we say, where they become irrevocable. There's a point where you have done so much and that person has relied on that license you've given them. They've invested in it. They changed their position based on it. That you can't just pull it out from under them. This adoption sometimes you might see also occurs in contract law, where people kind of rely on representations to such a point that to kind of pull out the carpet from under them feels unfair and inequitable. Okay, so this is why we're in the realm of arguing that this is going to be estoppel, or in some jurisdictions called an irrevocable license. How do we determine whether or not something meets the requirements of an easement by estoppel? What should we look at? You mean like the elements?
Yeah, exactly. What's the test, the elements?
Permission. It's the first thing. They're going to permission to use land.
Mm-hmm.
And if they become, like, dependent on the fact that they let them use the land, I think that's one. And
all right, okay, so we'll start here. So this is described slightly differently in different cases. We see prior to this case in Ohio, the Ohio said, when a landowner misleads or causes another in any way to change position based on, and it leads to prejudice. Or where a landowner without objection permits another to kind of invest money and spend money. That seems to be not the greatest test. So the Ohio court here is adopting the restatement approach, which is a little bit cleaner. They don't kind of go through the elements that clearly in the case, but you do see it kind of following up in the case. All right, so here's the standard. The landowner permits another to use land in circumstances in which it was reasonable to foresee that the user would substantially change position. Believing that permission would not be revoked, the user did change position. So notice what this means. It's like a three-part thing. One is that the landowner, the servient estate, does something that makes the dominant user, the easement holder, believe that they have an easement. And then that easement holder then makes changes, does something to rely on that representation that there's an easement. So here's another way to put it. The landowner allows another to use his land, right? This is what Jordan started with saying, right? Like that they had permission to start with. We can think of this as they have created a license. They created what looks like a license. They've given you permission to use their land as a driveway, as a sewage line, as a place to go hunting every fall, something like that. And they create this license. The licensee, who we think of as the easement holder, relies in good faith on that license. Usually making changes, either to their land, making some investment, making physical improvements. So maybe you make physical improvements to your land, like you build your sewage line to your neighbor's house instead of investing in building it up over the creek bed in a different way. Maybe you go out and you buy a car because your neighbor has told you you can have access to the driveway, right? All of those types of things. That you've actually done something to invest in it. So if they just told you can have an easement, then you don't really do anything about it. You don't really kind of change your position. That's not going to be enough. You have to actually show that the person who's the easement holder, the licensee, has relied upon that representation. And finally, the licensor, the landowner, the servient estate owner, if you will, knows or reasonably should expect that such reliance would occur. Okay, Jordan, so looking at this test here, is that test met here?
Yes.
All right, so what is it? So what was the license? I know it seems... Let's just go step by step, make sure we have all the elements. So how would we describe the first element being met here? What would you say?
Well, it wasn't down, but they had an agreement that she could use the land.
Right, so they had an oral agreement that sure looked like a license. Okay, did the licensee then, did the Bauer family rely upon that license and undertake an action that made physical improvements or incurred costs?
Yes.
And what would those be?
They used their property, so they dug over to like the little valley was. And use their property instead of going the other way that they could have gone.
Yeah, so just to show you, this is how we would, right? If you're applying we got our test, we want to analyze, we want to apply the facts of our case, we'd be like, here's number two, is that they actually invested money as they dug into the sewer line and made improvements and changes to both to their land. And then the third one, should the landowner know or reasonably know that reliance would occur?
Yeah,
I think this is a harder one to show quite often. It's really easy to show that the person has spent money or made changes to their land. This is not too hard in this case, but often this would be the element that trips you up a little bit. Did the landowner, was
it reasonable for the landowner to realize that that person was going to make changes? Here I think it's not too hard of a case to say, yeah, they knew their sewage line was going there. They would. It is not the type of thing that you expect to build multiple items up, right? You don't expect to change your sewage line and build another route 5 years later. It is not the type of license we expect people to revoke. Courts often add in just an element of discussing the justice of it, and we see that in this case, right? Suggesting that injustice can be avoided only by recognizing this easement. We have to recognize such an easement, otherwise it just isn't fair. It would be unjust to let them change their mind. That is a very squishy test, right? And we see that gives a lot of discretion to a judge in her equitable power to kind of make that decision of whether or not justice could be avoided. Equitable considerations are usually quite important in cases like this. A lot of kind of just thinking about not almost the test, but as much as like kind of just the background facts and fairness. What do you feel would be right is often the type of thing we see judges discussing in equitable estoppel cases. So even though we have this three-part test here, often the cases themselves are much more fact-based than some of our other ones, right? Implied by prior use, you have to have severance of unity, right? Like, you're not going to go anywhere if you don't meet that element. Easement by estoppel, court might be a little bit more willing to just be like, well, what kind of was the relationship with these landowners? What did this easement look like? How hard would it be to do something else? They ask very practical questions. All right. So So when we think about how long easements last, when we talk about an easement by necessity, we usually say that the easement lasts for as long as the necessity lasts. Right. So if a new road was built, a new sewage line came in, we would end that easement by necessity. How long do you think we should allow an irrevocable license to last? Is there any time that this would naturally expire? Ben?
Sort of a natural life expectancy. So in this case, this and the pipes were about ready for around 50 years. So 100 years later, you might have an argument that there's no point.
There's no point because these pipes aren't any good?
Remember that when they installed them, they didn't intend for it to last 100 years. They intended it for.
So when it comes time to replace the pipes, there's a good argument that they should take a new pathway with those pipes?
I'd say a stronger argument.
A stronger argument. You could see them still arguing, though, like, this is where the ditch already is. It's a lot, makes a lot more sense to just replace these pipes than to dig a new ditch, and especially when it has to. I mean, this is not a great view of the property, actually. This is the creek bed here, and they would have to kind of go, kind of, like, I don't know, build something over the creek bed or dig really deep to go under it to avoid it. Any other ideas about how we might figure out how long they should last? A good test we could develop? Again, it's a kind of a squishy one. Tim, you got an idea?
Well, if it's really irrevocable, it ends.
Forever.
Or we have to call it something different. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's why some places call it the easement by estoppel. Generally, the rule is as long as you need it to last to avoid injustice. I don't know how long that is. I think it makes it similar to an easement by necessity standard almost, right? So if actually there was a new sewage line that was built or a new road that came in and it no longer felt unjust to make them move their sewage line, then you would say it was done. But it's not a clear-cut answer. Last how long we need it to last to avoid injustice. Okay. All right, now that we've gone through all of our methods of creation, there's one left, and I kind of already told you we were going to hold off on this, which is condemnation. And we'll just talk about this in the context of eminent domain, which we get to in about 2 weeks from now. So condemnation is kind of the actual government kind of taking of an easement and paying you in exchange for it. Now that we know how easements are created, I want to look at a couple other rules regarding easements, including the scope of the easement and then how easements end. So let's start with interpreting easements.
Interpreting easements, our first case really gets at the scope of easement. And these are kind of questions that some of you have already asked here and there, like how much can you use an easement? How big can it be? How long can you take more cars? And if I build a single family home and I have one car and I just am driving it back and forth on my driveway, my easement, can I then build a two-family home and still use that same road? Could I build a hotel and still use that road for everybody? Like, how much can we expand an easement, and what are the rules going to be? Okay, so easement rules. Transferability. So transferability. Easements are freely transferable unless it says otherwise. Our default with all property rights is that you can transfer them. The only limitation on this is that sometimes easements engrossed are limited by statute and therefore can't be transferred, right? So if you remember an easement engrossed, that is an easement that's held not by somebody based on their status as a landowner, but just based on their individual status. The most popular example of an easement engrossed? What's our most common easement engrossed? Sean?
Electric lines.
Utility, all different types of utility lines, right? It's not based on the fact that the like gas company or the electric company is your next door neighbor. It's based on who they are. Even those are often transferable, right? A new electricity company, a new water company comes into town, they can usually transfer that easement. But sometimes if you look in statute, there's a limit on the transferability of easements and gross that are not utility easements. Divisibility. Can you divide up the easement? If you have an easement that's for, 50 feet wide, could you kind of give somebody else part of the easement? Yes, sometimes. The extent is another way of saying scope. So let's think about scope and look at the Marcus Cable case. And I swear I saw Matt. Did he disappear? Isn't he sitting like right there? It's like it's amazing. Even just going to the bathroom like means I pull your card, right? It's like a talent. I took out everybody's card who wasn't here today to avoid that. Andy.
Yeah.
Here, he's here. What's going on here? Tell us about the easement.
Yeah. So the property owners here back in 1939, predecessor to the defendants, signed an easement. Got an easement with the Hill County Electric Co-op to provide power lines to the property. Then Hill County merged with Marcus Cable Associates, and part of their agreement was to allow the cable company to furnish television and antenna services to the areas that were served by the co-op.
Yeah.
So what they wanted to do was extend putting these antennas on some of the land that they served, including the Crohn's property. And however, the contract stipulated that that they could only do so lawfully. So they couldn't do. And the problem here is that the Crohn's don't want this cable line or the antenna on their property because it's not part of the easement. That's what the court said.
All right. Oh, so. How is this easement created? Is this estoppel, prescription, implied, express?
I think it was express.
It's an express easement. The fact that there's language that we're discussing means that it's a written down express easement. So we have an express easement between the Crown's predecessor, I don't even know if we know who they are, and they granted an easement to the Hill County Electric Cooperative, and the exact phrase is, for an electric transmission or distribution line or system. So as I mentioned before, when we have an express easement, often what we're dealing with is just trying to interpret the terms and words of that express easement. So it's an express easement, and the cooperative, the Hill County Electric Cooperative, I guess installed utility poles. This is actually not a picture of it. I just love these pictures of easements where they trim the trees to avoid the poles. All right, so they strung cables carrying electric current above the air. And then when did this happen? When was this easement first entered into?
The original one.
1939, so quite a while ago, right? This is a 2002 case. We're talking about a long time ago that this easement started. It's in 1991. The only thing I want to make to what you said, Andy, is I just be careful. I don't know if it's a merger of the companies. The companies entered into a cooperative, like a joint use agreement. So they're not the same company, which might make a difference, right? So it's not really that Hill County Electric Cooperative is starting to do this thing. It's that they've entered into this kind of cooperative agreement with the cable company that says, hey, you can use our poles that we already built, right? We already built the poles. If you want to string up your cable lines along those poles, you can do so as long as... Andy?
As long as you do so lawfully.
As long as you do so lawfully. So it's up to you to make sure that the easements and everything are correctly in place. We're not going to kind of make any... Hill County Electric Company is not going to make any statement about the lawfulness of where these easements can go. All right, so... So Marcus Cables then put up a bunch of cable lines over land all over the place, including land over the land owned by the Crones. Why are the Crones complaining? Why are they bringing suit here?
Because they don't want them stringing it over the property.
Yeah, they don't. I don't even know how they knew it was there. I'm not sure I can look up at the lines and understand which line is going to which thing in my neighborhood. But 7 years later, the Crones sue Marcus Cable for trespass. You're trespassing by putting this line through my yard, and they seek an injunction to compel removal of the lines and kind of other type of relief. All right, so... Would it have been permissible for the electric company to have transferred its easement to somebody else? Yes, freely alienable. You can transfer easements. Even though this is an easement in gross, we allow transfer of utility easements. What is the problem here? Is the problem... So we have transfer, so why is there a challenge?
Because it's outside the scope of what the parties intended. This is what we're writing. The context is important.
You can only transfer what you have. So there's no prohibition on the electric company transferring its easement, but its easement says an electric transmission or distribution line or system. So the only type of easement it can convey to somebody else is something that is for that exact same thing. It cannot change on its own its scope or interpretation of the easement. It can't change the nature of what that easement is for. Now, notice the practical means of this, though. One easement is for hanging wires. So the easement is for hanging wires, but it says specifically what those wires could do. If it didn't say that, if it just said you can hang wires, there wouldn't be much of an issue here because the wires themselves do not look that different. And the fact that one of the arguments here is that there's not a real material difference to actually how it's impacting the Crone's land. It's not really any different having these black wires versus these blue wires. They're like the same kind of impact on your land and on the value of your land and things like that. All right. So when we one of the things that we try to do is we need to look at the purpose of the easement and see whether or not we think that this fits within that. So, Andy, is this fit in, or what is the argument saying that this fits into the description of an electric transmission or distribution line or system?
It does not. The court does not fit into that because they see this more as a transmit of communications, which is not what the easement expresses.
Yeah. What do you guys think? If somebody were to come up to you and say, okay, cable line, is that fit into an electric transmission line, or is that something different? Is that an electric transmission or distribution line or system? Cable. Does that sound like it fits that or not? Ian?
Yes.
Yeah, why?
I know this wasn't... the example I was thinking of, I guess maybe it sounds exaggerated, but... So since it will materially be the same and affect their land the same exact way, like hypothetically, if we found out like the nature of electricity was different than we realized before, and like the referent of electricity was a different thing, it wouldn't mean that all of a sudden the easement doesn't work because one of the words has like a different referent. It's really, the easement is about like the material impact of the property.
Is it though? I mean, right, so you could see that you might have somebody who is really only interested in providing energy and does not really, they don't like cable TV, they're against cable TV, and they don't want just any wire running through their property. They're very specific in the type of easement they're willing to grant, and it's not an easement that's just any wire. It's an easement just for electricity. Allie?
But it doesn't need any electric transmissions, and isn't there an argument that
cable transmissions are electric transmissions?
That's the argument that the dissent is making. It's like, actually, cable is an electrical signal. It's a type of electrical signal. And so then it should fall under the scope of this easement. The majority says, no, cable is about communication. So then now we're looking at kind of what is the purpose of it. One, electricity is about the purpose of bringing energy into your home so you can use it for, like, running your appliances and your lights and things like that. And cable is for the purpose of, I don't know, communication, high-speed internet, telephone, that type of thing. And these are kind of two different categories of things, and you can't take kind of this energy provision easement and encompass it in a communications easement. That's how the court reads it. Christian.
Did they specifically say in the easement that the electric transmission was for energy only?
No, they do not. They say, and this is why I have to keep going back to exact words, it says an electric transmission or distribution line system. So this is why this is, so now we have to figure out how should we interpret this easement when we have some ambiguity of what it might mean, particularly because we're talking about 1939 before cable TV is around. We have to try and think about how should we interpret an easement. Should we interpret it really narrowly to be just about what they intended it to be? Do we look at the intent of the parties and figure out what we think the parties probably intended it to be? Do you think that the parties in 1939, when they were negotiating this easement, do you think that they intended it to cover cable television lines, Andy?
Probably not.
Programs were transmitted during, like, really probably mostly during the air, over airwaves, like radio waves and stuff like that at the time. It wasn't transmitted over TV. So in that way, we might argue that if we are just going by the intent of the original parties to this easement, what they intended, there was unlikely any evidence that they intended it to cover cable television lines. Tim?
If we allow a cable line to be an electric transmission, just because electricity is involved at some point, don't we have to say, like, any line, like a sewer line, if there's electricity anywhere at the beginning or the end, that becomes an electric line too, and then that seems crazy.
Is it for transmission of electricity, though? I'm just giving you what the dissent's argument was, that there actually are electrical signals here. So the idea is now what we need to take from this case, though, is trying to look at an easement and trying to figure out how we're going to interpret the scope of an easement because easements often are perpetual. They last forever. So we have to look at an easement that was written at a time before people actually contemplated some of the circumstances we have today, before people contemplated things like cable TV. Right? So what does that mean? How do we read that scope as expanding? Generally, we say the manner, frequency, intensity of an easement's use may change over time to accommodate technological development. I'll say that again. Manner, frequency, and intensity of the easement's use can change over time to accommodate technological development, but not to change its use entirely. So if we figure out that electricity lines should be a little higher or to be more efficient, if we figure out that they should be a little thicker, right? All of those types of things are kind of accommodating technological developments and are considered to be still within the scope of an easement that's for electrical lines. Whether or not in fact, the court even mentions how other cases about telecommunications, about telephone lines, should encompass cable lines. That is, that cable, while not being a technological innovation associated with electricity, is a technological innovation associated with telecommunications. So if our easement had said something about telecommunications, maybe that would be a totally fine kind of expansion of it. It really kind of gets at whether or not we should define the purpose of an easement narrowly or broadly, and they are generally defined narrowly. Right? Along this idea of we want as few restraints on the land as possible. We want usually our easements to be as narrow as possible. We tend to put our public policy in favor of the fee simple landowner instead of in favor of the easement holder. We want them to kind of have the most flexibility. And an idea being that then if someone like a cable company really wants an easement, they should go back to those landowners and now negotiate for that easement, not just expand and try to piggyback on one that already exists. All right. So there. I don't remember if I have any slides. So we have these become a little bit tricky. For example, what if you have an 1880 easement that says you have access for a wagon to cross the land? Should we allow that to be expanded to include automobiles? What do you think, Andy?
I would think so. They do the same purpose.
So that generally is thought of to be the same purpose. It's like transportation, and it's a technological advance of coming from wagons to cars, right? Okay, what if you have an easement that's a right-of-way? This happens a lot of times. People have an easement that's a right-of-way, like a driveway through the land. If I have a driveway through your land, or some of the cases we've seen here, could you also use that same driveway to install perhaps utility lines underneath the driveway? Should that be allowed? Will's like, yes, of course.
Well, like, unless you're really going to disturb the driveway for a long time to install it.
But notice that's not what you bargained for. If you bargain for a right of way access from land A, like so my driveway, so I can get to the road. That's what I have negotiated an easement for. Now I want to also install utilities, and I'm going to use my same pathway. I'm just going to put it under that driveway. Could I still?
I thought you meant the homeowner who granted.
No. I'm talking about the easement holder. Can the easement holder expand their... You're right.
No.
The landowner can do whatever they want under that driveway as long as they don't interfere with that person's easement. But could the easement holder who has a right-of-way, particularly if it's phrased as a right-of-way, is that just for transportation now? Or could we also use that for something bigger like access for utilities? Could you put it under your driveway? Alec?
I think it would depend on the way the easement was agreed upon. Like if it was agreed upon as an access way, I think you could argue that it is a way to allow any kind of access into the property, including utilities. But I think if it's just as a driveway and a mode of transportation between the original, like the road and your land,
yeah,
I think you'd have to go with a separate easement.
That's exactly right. So right-of-way, when people just use the phrase right-of-way, that's been interpreted quite broadly to kind of be anything kind of giving access, especially, and so they've allowed people to put utility lines like underneath the driveway, for example, run your sewage pipe under your driveway easement, because right-of-way is considered to be kind of access to your property. That's a pretty expansive interpretation. Doesn't seem too close in keeping with our Marcus case, where they go so narrowly about what the transmission line. But again, we have to look at the phrase. But if the phrase is you can use this for your cars to access this, or you can use this for transportation, if anything is specifically named there, we will construe it narrowly to be that. I think part of this is just easements are often so old. An 1880 easement is not unusual. The easement in my house is from 1900s, right? And so things change, right? Things change a lot in the intervening years. And so we want to construe them. We want to kind of think both about making them useful and taking into account things we hadn't considered 100 years ago, but at the same time not kind of abusing the landowner who might have agreed to something more limited. Francis?
In the instance we keep the wagon, if someone had a wagon access after the invention of automobiles, that would imply that they specifically...
Yes, I think that's a good argument. I think if today you enter into an easement that says you can access my land by wagon, I think that's a suggestion that the technological advances in wagons are not leading to cars, right? Technological advances in wagons, I don't know, or like maybe fancier wheels or something. I don't know. Yeah, but absolutely. That's why we have to look at the kind of the time and the circumstances, duration of easements. How long do easements last? Forever. Many easements are perpetual, and perpetual in most jurisdictions is the default. So if you don't say anything within the easement, we assume it lasts forever. Right? And the default, this is what it would look like. You have an easement to use the lake on this property. It doesn't say anything in it. We assume that means forever. Term easements. You can have an easement that is just names a specific term.
Specific number of years. We saw one of these. I can't remember which case we had. It was a 75. The Millbrook Hunt, right? It was a 75-year easement to go hunting on that land.
You can also have defeasible easements. Ooh. Thought we weren't going to see that word again.
Defeasible easements. What does defeasible mean?
I know.
Cut short.
There's a way, so you have an easement that might be perpetual or might be for certain, but you have an easement that might be cut short by the occurrence of a specific event. So you can have an easement that says something like this. It's a little small. You have an easement to use the lake on my property to practice swimming until you get your lifeguard certification. Right? That looks kind of like a fee simple determinable, but it's in an easement form. So we call that an easement determinable. You have an easement to use the lake on my property to practice swimming until you get your lifeguard certification, and then I have the power to terminate that easement. Right? Easement subject to a condition subsequent. So you can see how we can take those phrases that we've learned in other types of property rights and add, and in our present possessory rights, and add them onto our non-possessory rights as well. You don't see these very often. Most easements are much more straightforward than this. You have an easement to use lake on my property, practice swimming until you get your lifeguard certification, and that right transfers to your sister. Right? Easement subject to executory limitation. So you see it just looks exactly like those fee simple, the defeasible fees, but now we can just have them on easements as well. I'm not going to test you on that. I just want you to kind of realize that that is a thing that is out there and that you might see. It is a way one could write an easement if you wanted to. And you can see why you might want that. You can see why there might be a circumstance where it makes sense. You can have an easement to hunt on my land for as long as, I don't know, as long as you maintain good gun safety rules. And if not, then I'm going to take it away, right? But let's look at termination of easement. So we've talked about the creation. Now let's look at their death. Right? So, and all of the ones that I just gave us the list for, those are all ones that have kind of, they just expire, we would say. Everything on that previous slide are easements that, well, not the perpetual ones, but the term easements or the defeasible easements, those expire when upon either the reaching the number of years or just expire upon the event. You can also have something called a release. A release is effectively kind of giving that easement back to the servient estate. It is you as the easement holder saying, I no longer need this easement anymore. These are done expressly. Statute of fraud requires it to be in writing because you are giving up a significant property right. Sometimes you might do this for money. Right, so if you have a driveway easement, but you're going to build a driveway on another part of your property, you might release the servient estate. You might go to your neighbor and say, hey, if you give me $1,000, I'll get rid of that easement on your property. And we'll sign it in the lease. We'll put it in your deed. Your property will be worth more. Estoppel. Ooh, so notice now we're going to see some of the same ideas we saw for creation coming up with termination. If the servient estate owner relies to his detriment upon a representation or promise of the easement owner. So we can picture this being something like, I have a driveway through your land, and I tell you, you know what, I'm building another driveway. I don't really need that one anymore. I'm going to use something else. And then you're like, great, I'm going to pave this over and create a nice patio in my backyard, and I watch you do that. I can't then come back and say, oh, no, I want that easement again. Right? I have made representations to you. You have relied upon those representations to your detriment. I cannot, for reasons of justice, come back in and change my mind. So you can actually destroy the easement by that same idea of estoppel, making representations and the person relying on it to their detriment. Merger. You cannot have an easement in your own property. Right? If I have a driveway on my property, I don't say that I have an easement across my own property. I just say I have a driveway. Right?
So one of the ways that easements end is if the property is the landowner becomes the owner of the land with the with the easement on it. This happens, right? So, right, our typical right-of-way easement, we have parcels A and B, and A has this pathway, right? So we have this, the dominant estate, surveyed estate. If A buys B, they become the landowner here. We no longer say that there's an easement there, right? We just say that this landowner has a driveway. It's a destruction of the easement by merger.
Abandonment. And we'll talk about this in the context of our case. Let's see. I think we can get to it. All right. An easement owner can abandon an easement. They can just kind of stop using it. But the circumstances have to be very clear. Abandonment can be hard to determine. And it changes in some contexts. Some contexts, non-use is enough, but usually you need a really affirmative act to show abandonment. And this should sound familiar to you, because this is a similar way we talk about abandonment in other contexts. Right? When we talked about abandonment of property, we needed people to really affirmatively show that they meant to abandon property. We don't just assume that people mean to abandon things. So in the same way, we don't usually assume that somebody means to abandon their easement. They have to kind of make there's got to be some more evidence than that. And how much more evidence we require is going to differ a little bit by jurisdiction and going to differ a lot by what the type of easement is. Prescription. Again, adverse possession. All right, now we've got adverse possession as a way to end an easement. So let's say you have an easement, but somebody else is just like kind of continuously using it. And by somebody else, I mean the servient landowner. So now we have our servient landowner. Let's go back into two parcels, and this guy puts up a fence here. So he disrupts your use, disrupts A's use of the easement, and for whatever it is, let's say it's for 10 years, you don't do anything about that. They have clearly, open and notoriously, kind of disrupted your use of the easement. They filled it in and planted a garden here. And they are kind of using prescription to end your easement. They are preventing you from using your easement. And you just watch that happen for 10 years without doing anything. And we think of the same elements that we would think of, right? Is it open and notorious? Is it continuous? Is it hostile? If you do that with the permission of A, if he says, oh, that's okay, you can put up that fence there for a while. I don't mind, like, opening and closing it. I don't mind driving over your garden. Then it's not hostile. Yeah.
Just a quick practical question about all the easements in general. Do you get a whole new deed every time something like this happens?
It's usually an attachment to your deed. So if you go do a title search, it might be a fun thing to do, go do a title search. The documents can get longer and longer. This is actually why it can be easy to lose track of easements and rights and land, and why we don't like them too much. Because as our land recording systems have gotten better, we get a lot better at doing these title searches and getting all the documents. But some of my research projects in particular, I research conservation easements, many of those just get lost. And so you do your diligent title search and you pull them up, but if they weren't kind of attached, they weren't stapled correctly to the right piece of paper, if they weren't put in the computer system correctly, people might lose track of them. It definitely happens with these easements. And the land recording systems differ by county. So there's a lot of counties in the United States and a lot of differences of how good they are at their land recording systems.
Yeah. Is an example of the prescription of the land easement like the case Mary had where they put the gate up, or no?
Yeah, right. So that could have been, but it just wasn't long enough. But that absolutely could have become a prescriptive determination of the easement by prescription. First, we'd have to show it was an easement, right? So, but let's say we show that it's an easement, and the state then puts up that gate and doesn't let them have access, and they do so open and notoriously, hostility, you know, for the statutory period, then we would say that the easement has terminated by prescription.
And it can only be done then by the servient landowner. Can't, let's say under B there was then seized property,
yes,
and he starts to use the driveway.
Well, I was trying to think about that, of whether or not you could terminate by somebody else.
Yeah.
It seems to me that there's no reason why you couldn't, but I've never seen a case where that's happened.
Because my thought then was, originally, though, this relationship was between A and B, so if C technically, you know, B's, he's just then using it, and there's no way that then it was, like, ever agreed upon or implied or needed, and there was that thing between then B and C. To, like, establish the creation that for someone else.
Yeah, I mean, we could sit around here and think about it. We might be able to come up with a situation where the person who actually destroyed the easement by prescription was not the underlying landowner. I haven't seen a case like that, but I've not seen it's not possible. I think maybe we could kind of probably sit here and come up with a scenario where it would work.
Do you have a question? No, I was imagining that. Okay, and then condemnation again. Right. This usually happens when a government entity condemns uses eminent domain to take a piece of property. They usually condemn the property plus all the easements on there, so that the government has it free and clear. When they do so, then there's often complicated calculations of how much you pay the easement holder versus the fee title landowner and stuff like that. And sometimes they condemn a piece of property and don't take the easement. Sometimes they just condemn the easement. See all different arrangements here.
Could you explain the termination by estoppel one more time?
Yeah, so the idea of all of our ideas of estoppel all involve somebody making representations to you and you relying upon them to your detriment. So an easement by terminating by estoppel is, now we have this easement going through A and B, and what happens is B says, you know what, I don't really need that easement anymore because I am just going to... A says to B, here's the easement. And A says, you know what, I don't really need that easement across your property anymore, B, because I'm actually just going to go make a new driveway connect to the road out here. He makes a representation to the servient landowner that the easement is no longer needed, and the servient landowner then relies upon that representation to his detriment, makes some type of investment or improvement in the property, spends some money, changes some property. So what do? They go and they build a big garden right here, they make a patio right here. A watches them do that, doesn't say anything. We say it would be unjust, inequitable, for A to come back and say, you know what, I actually didn't really like that road, this was easier for me, I could get to work quicker this way, so I want that easement back. Stop. We won't let them do that anymore. So,
do they absolutely have to invest money into that land that initially had the easement?
They have to do something that relies on, that we have to do something to their detriment. They can't, so if A says, I don't need that easement anymore because I'm going to build my road out this way, and B says, okay, but B doesn't do anything, B doesn't change her position at all, she doesn't kind of change anything on this path, she doesn't invest any money, she doesn't go like advertise this as a property with no easement on it, she hasn't done anything differently, we'll let A change her mind and use the easement again. So B has to somehow change position. Usually we measure that change in position by B investing money or making physical changes to the physical improvements to the property. Sam?
Purchasing or leasing property, is the landowner's responsibility to disclose any easements on the property, or is it the buyer's responsibility to actually go and look at the title and make sure?
What are you guys saying? Let's see what the people who work in this area say.
Yeah, so it's the buyer, and you have to be really dominant.
Absolutely. This is why you do title search. Right? It is assumed that a buyer has gone and done the title search and understands what the encumbrances are on the property. This changed a little bit when we didn't used to have land recording systems. This is why we actually, there was like, we thought of things as like, we looked at how much notice they had and how easy it was for them to get notice. Now we assume that buyers can get notice by just going and doing the title search. This is why people get title insurance as well, to make sure that somebody has actually kind of legitimately done a decent job of pulling up all the restrictions on the property.
But then you said it sometimes there's like, you'll find one from 100 years ago.
Yeah.
How does that work in that situation?
Like, there's a couple different things that can happen. And there's one thing that I was mentioning last time that's in chapter 8 that I'm not going to cover, that's this idea of a bona fide purchaser. If there's really kind of new work, there was no way you could have had notice.
we don't apply that. So that gets a little tricky. It's in chapter 8 if you want to read it. I'm not going to cover it here because it really goes hand in hand with mortgages. The other thing we can do is, the other thing you see people do is sue the title companies for doing a shitty job. Right? Or sue your attorney who did not find, who did not do all of the research they should have done in before the purchase of your home. So this is why it's important for you guys.
Sometimes they'll find something that like they can't find individually. Like, it could be a name on some bank that doesn't exist, and one out of business could be real. But there's no way to really extinguish it, so you basically have to take out extra title insurance. Everyone understands that this railroad that doesn't exist is going to tear your house down for something that's not there, but you have no official kind of.
And this is also why people end up doing quiet title options. Sometimes to try and clear any kind of these old encumbrances out of the way, they'll have title, quiet title action to kind of get rid of kind of these remaining things around that it's in the
frame. Just happened to me like recently with the sale where the owner of the home that I sold didn't know that there was an easement on their property because there's a pond back there, but it's like a pond that only you can access, but the whole neighborhood has rights to the pond that she didn't know about when she purchased the home 3 years ago in Snyder. And the purchaser found it in the title search and then like brought it.
It happens all the time. And we can see, cases where it's the reason why a sale will fall apart sometimes. Or just people just don't realize all the things of the property. Or they get the easement that they don't necessarily, like, they can be really long and kind of confusing to read. Some conservation easements, which I study in particular, like, can be tricky to even understand what the restrictions are. So a homeowner might not even realize what it means when they see this. All right, well, so we'll terminate our easement discussion.